Serve It Cold, Episode 7. Written by Ronnie Blackwell, presented by Dancing Cat Studios.
Hello? Aunt Helen! Well, isn't this a surprise? Of course you can call your favorite niece out of the blue. How are you? What's up in the big city of Catherine, Mississippi? Yeah. So let me get this straight. This guy, Johnny C., is a mini-mart clerk in Crosstown? Right. And you think I might run into him down here in the Big Easy? Aunt Helen, you do know New Orleans is a big city, right? It's not like back home in Catherine where everyone knows everybody else and their dog. You know, that reminds me, there's an art exhibit opening tonight at a gallery in the quarter called the Catherine 40. Like there's really only 40 people living there. Now I know there's more than 40 people in Catherine. Right. So, Aunt Helen, this Johnny C. fella, what's he look like? You know, in case I see him walking the streets of the quarter or something. So, he's a big white man, walks with a cane, yeah, full black beard. Get out! No, ma'am, I didn't mean any disrespect. Aunt Helen, he was at Margaritaville today, at one of my tables. That's right, they sat there forever. Yeah, he had this, girl with him. What? Tall, athletic. Pretty. To tell you the truth, she didn't look like his type, but you can never tell down here in the quarter. Oh, yeah, definitely tall enough to play basketball, and with the heels she was wearing, near about as tall as this Johnny C. you're asking about. Narlene Moore. No, I don't think I know her, but I suppose it could have been her, if the description fits. So, wait a minute now, I'm confused. This Johnny C., is he supposed to be a mini-mart clerk or some private detective looking for this Narlene Moore or some kind of drug dealer or what? What do you mean, what do I mean? Well, the girl ate everything on the menu. I was bringing tray after tray of burgers and conch fritters and whatnot to the table. You would not believe how heavy those trays can get. Right, well, after they finished eating, they ordered coffee and dessert. You know, that great key lime pie we have. And Steve, the manager, was talking them up all along like he's bosom buddies with the white guy. So I'm hanging around, making sure they get good service, refilling their drinks, whisking empty plates out of the way, and I'm catching snippets of what they're talking about. Mostly it's the girl talking, something about somehow getting mixed up with these sleazeballs and getting in their car and heading for New Orleans and only then finding out just what asshole she got mixed up with. Yes, ma'am. Sorry, ma'am. I will. Well, I tell you what, I would not want to have been in her shoes, especially after she finds out they're the ones that beat up this friend of her brother's. Sonny something, I think. So as soon as they get down here, she barricades herself in the bedroom and won't come out. Nope, not a chance. She was onto them and was having none of it. Yeah. And then later, after the really psycho one, Ray, goes out, she tricks someone who was supposed to be watching her, Jerry, into falling asleep, tosses all his clothes over the railing into the courtyard next door so he can't follow her unless he wants to be walking down the street buck naked. And, well, that's still illegal in the quarter. Sounded to me like she rescued herself. They made a bunch of calls from their cell phones, and while they were at the restaurant, I think they called the Catherine cops at one point. Well, I missed that part, Aunt Helen. I covered 10 tables, and we were hopping. A table for 13 came in then, and next thing I know, they're up and left. Now, how would I know that, Aunt Helen? I didn't fall them down the street. No, they didn't have to pay the bill. Steve covered it. Yeah, left a pretty good tip, though.
We went around the corner to California Drawstrings and bought Narlene some things to wear, including a cotton shell with a hood that would make her less noticeable. Of course, walking next to me might well prove a dead giveaway to the Pringle gang. She changed in the store, and the loose cotton clothes went a long way to altering her appearance. Narlene was still striking, but different striking now. Next, we walked toward the river on St. Peter, then uptown on Charters, found a shoe shop, and bought her some sandals. As I watched the cashier total up the purchase, I got this premonition that it would be a very long time before my credit card worked its way out of the freezer again. The sandals chopped some inches off her height, bringing her down to under 6 feet. Looking at those long legs, I suddenly realized that we should have bought running shoes. I would have bet that there was nobody in the quarter that could catch Narlene Moore in a foot race. I glanced at the weakened credit card. Maybe later. We backtracked to Toulouse. I again walked diagonally through the intersection to take the sidewalk away from the cars. When I got there, I realized that Narlene hadn't come across with me. She was standing in the middle of the street, looking at the very first car on the block. A green Bonneville, mid-80s would be my guess. I crossed back over, and with a hand on her back, guided her out of the street. I could feel her shivering. Is this it?
I think so. He's already back, isn't he?
Cane at the ready, just in case Ray Dude was snoozing in the back seat, I approached close enough to see that it was full of pizza-flavored Pringles cans. I think we've got the right car. Well, they may be big-time criminals, but at least they don't litter. Narlene came up beside me.
Oh, the Pringles cans. They tried to throw them out, but I wouldn't let them.
I glanced over at her. She was steadily scanning for Ray. Then I saw the parking ticket. I plucked it off the windshield and tried to decipher the ticketing officer's scrawl. Luckily, the city had thoughtfully provided some checkboxes. I stepped back and looked at the car. Its front wheels were sitting just out of the parking zone outline. No, I think that Ray is not back. This car was ticketed at 7:45 this morning. Too close to the intersection. Towing offense. It's a wonder it's still sitting here. Ray wouldn't have had time to drive to Catherine and back in that amount of time. Either he didn't go to Catherine at all, or, more likely, he took another car. But it won't hurt to get you off the streets for a bit. Come on. We don't have far to go now. A flight of bubbles zipped by, and we headed upwind into the flow. At NOLA USA, Tommy assured me that Nick and Patty's place didn't have anyone in it, at least until the weekend, and that he would give me a call if he noticed anyone moving the Bonneville parked down the street. While Narlene looked through the treasures of NOLA USA, I huddled with Tommy, bringing him up to date, and recruiting him and his partner in providing Narlene backup while I was out later spying on the Granthams. I also left a message for Butch with Marianne, saying that the car I had described earlier was parked in a tow-away zone in the 600 block of Toulouse, but I thought that Raganet actually did head to Catherine early in the morning in another car. I went ahead and gave her the complete tag number so they could trace the car. I was already dreading the hard time that B&E were going to give me over this wild goose chase. The St. Louis Cathedral bells were ringing 2 o'clock as we climbed the winding stairs to Patty and Nick's third-floor apartment. I unlocked the door and went on into the tiny kitchen to stow the muffalettas, while Narlene walked on into the apartment. As usual, the last people to stay in the apartment had left the kitchen well-stocked with beer and bottled water. I entered the living room with a couple of bottles of water in my hands and met Narlene coming from the other way.
Johnny C., there's one bedroom and one bed here.
Don't get the butcher knife out yet, Narlene. The bedroom's all yours. In fact, I've got my own hotel room right down the street tonight. I stopped as I saw alarm register in her face. Now don't worry. I'm not going anywhere soon, and you won't be alone. Tommy and his partner live in the second floor apartment, and they'll hold down the fort tonight. I promise I won't leave until they close the shop and get situated for the evening. She calmed down a bit, but still looked a bit pensive.
Just what kind of business are you doing all night in a hotel room, Johnny C.? Why can't I go with you?
You can't go with me because Goat Johnson would kill me quick if I took his baby sister along to watch me take pictures of adults behaving badly. And my wife Vera would kill me very slowly if I came to New Orleans and spent the night in a fancy hotel with Miss Congeniality. She laughed a little.
Miss Hospitality.
Oh, God. Even worse. And that's not to mention the fact that you will be much safer right here anyway. I went back to the kitchen and exchanged one of the bottles of water for an Abita Turbo Dog. I looked in the snack cabinet and almost laughed out loud. It was too good to be true. I re-entered the living room, gave Narlene the beer, and sat down in Mick Cole's easy chair. Narlene sat in a bent wood rocker and opened her beer.
What's this? Are you corrupting a minor now?
This is Louisiana, and I'm sure that every 19-year-old in South Mississippi knows that the drinking age in New Orleans is 18.
Almost 20.
You won't always be so ready to add that extra year. Here, have a snack with your beer. I threw her the pizza-flavored Pringles I found in the kitchen. Narlene caught the tube reflexively, then let it drop to the floor.
Oh no, never again.
When I finished laughing, I realized that we hadn't opened the apartment up. Man, it's stuffy in here. Let's get some air flowing. Narlene helped me unhook and open the heavy wooden shutters fronting the windows that separate the apartment from the stairway landing. Then we walked out to the landing to open the windows that overlook the courtyard. It was the first good look that Narlene had gotten of the courtyard and the Escher-esque jumble of stairways, rooftop gardens, and apartments flowing from one courtyard to another in the interior of the block.
Wow. This is amazing.
Yeah? The facades of the buildings in the quarter are sort of like the backdrops in a play. They set the scene for the tourists. The real living of the quarter goes on inside the blocks.
Jerry's place was nothing like this, though.
Yeah, I think right here in between St. Peter and Toulouse is where you get the best views. But this is the only area that I really know. You never can tell from the outside of the block. We walked back through the apartment to the bedroom and opened the heavy shutters and then the French windows leading to the Royal Street balconies. Immediately, a cooling breeze swept through the apartment along with the sounds of the street band below. Each window had its own small balcony. Narlene, welcome to the best show in New Orleans. You can see uptown on Royal all the way to Canal, downtown on Royal all the way to Esplanade, and you can see down Toulouse all the way to the river. Right down there, you can see the bubbles coming up from NOLA USA, and further down the street, you can still see the Bonneville. If we hang out and watch this afternoon, we can see which guy shows up for the car.
This place must be great during Mardi Gras.
Absolutely. This corner is the epicenter of Mardi Gras. Okay, here are the ground rules. I don't want you to go out and stand on the balconies. They're safe, but we don't want to tempt fate and have Ray and Jerry come bopping along and see you standing up here. So what you do is grab a chair and pull it up to the edge of the door like this. And then you'll be able to hang out and see practically everything you can from the balcony anyway. You can find several pairs of sunglasses in the top drawer of that hutch over there. If you wear sunglasses and pull your hood up, even if they see you, they'll just think you're the Jackie O of Royal Street. We settled down into our chairs in the warm sun and let the sounds and sights of Royal Street pulse around us. Narlene, wide-eyed and determined to see everything, and me determined to catch a few extra Z's to help me get through the night. I told her to wake me up if she saw the guys, closed my eyes, and was gone. I woke up after a 30-minute nap and looked over to see that Narlene was still taking it all in. I hope I didn't drown out the music with my snoring.
Well, you were pretty loud, but they kept on playing anyway. What kind of guitars are those that look like they've got hubcaps on the faces?
Well, those are resonator guitars. They were invented by a couple of Eastern Europeans in the 20s for the National Guitar Company. I sang the first line of Graceland. Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. I looked over to see a totally blank look on Narlene's face. Oh, I guess you were about 5 then. It was a song by an old codger has-been named Paul Simon.
I'm not totally ignorant of music history, Johnny C., even when it is ancient and white. I know who Paul Simon is. I even know who Art Garfunkel is. In fact, I think I was able to recognize the song Graceland in spite of your very weak performance.
Okay, I won't sing again. Anyway, resonator guitars have metal cones in them to make them louder. One of the guys who invented the first one left National and started another company called Dobro. They're the weapons of choice for the quarter's finest street musicians. I noticed that Narlene had finished her Turbo Dog. There are plenty of beers in the fridge. Help yourself. She got up and stretched.
Thanks. Why aren't you drinking beer? Are you in recovery like Sonny?
No, I drink plenty of beer, but right now I'm working. I need to stay sharp, and I might need to stay awake all night. That's why I bought that pound of Sumatra from Dom. In fact, I'll get up and go with you and get a pot going. I've napped enough. While the coffee was brewing, I searched through the cupboard and found a box of Parmalat milk and made a venti iced latte. When I got back to the bedroom, I found Narlene sipping on a redback wheat beer and eating pizza-flavored Pringles. Oh no, not ever again. Isn't that what I heard? Narlene, we've got a whole shelf of snacks in there.
I know. I saw them. But these things sort of get to you, you know?
Well, in that case, hand me a stack. I can't really say that iced latte and pizza-flavored Pringles is a match made in heaven, but I could see how it might work better with a hoppy beer. And who am I, an avid nacho cheese Doritos with Pinot Blanc fan, to cast aspersions? I was thoughtfully nibbling on a Pringle when something caught my eye. It was just a flash of something, a movement that just wasn't right. I fished out my compact binoculars and scanned the area two blocks downtown on Royal near the intersection of St. Anne that led to Don's. Could find nothing out of the ordinary and put the glasses down. Had another Pringle, cogitated for a bit. Big John was a big fan of both cogitation and letting the revelations of your subconscious float to the top. By the time I had nibbled the Pringles down to nothing, I convinced myself that what had caught my attention might have been the yellow color of Latimer Grantham's 9/11. Could they still be cruising the streets looking for somebody? Something. With Royal blocked off for pedestrians, I would only be able to catch sight of them crossing over at the intersections. I once again tried the trick of mentally following the car down St. Anne to the square, left onto Chartres, over to Dumaine, then back to cross Royal again. I raised the glasses and watched the cars cross at Dumaine and two blocks further down to the next Lakeward Street, Ursulines, for 30 seconds. Rested my eyes and stared for another 30. No yellow Porsches in sight. As I lowered the binoculars, it happened again. Another flash of recognition, something just not right. I tried one more time, mindful of the melting ice in my neglected latte. This time I started at Ursulines and scanned down the right side of the street. And there he was. A skinny white guy, pasty white, walking down the street barefoot, no shirt. The only thing he had on was a pair of ill-fitting purple hip huggers, with the bell-bottom legs turned up in 6-inch cuffs. I had never seen the guy before, but I had watched Narlene leave the store a dozen times in those jeans. I gave a weak imitation of Big John's low whistle. "I'll be a suck egg mule." Narlene sat up.
"A what?"
I had to laugh. "Well, I'm ready to make another bet, Narlene. I'll bet the cost of another round of key lime pie that in the bag of clothes you packed when you came down here was that pair of purple hip huggers you've been wearing this summer."
"Yeah. Why? What's going on?"
"Well, although I've never seen the gentleman before, I'd say that Mr. Jerry Joachim has come to look for his car." I gave her the binoculars and pointed. "Look half a block past the first intersection here. He's coming from the right sidewalk into the middle of the street." When she found him, she gave an involuntary yelp. Then a couple of sounds that I thought might be sobs that collapsed into laughter.
"Oh my God, he is! That sorry son of a bitch is wearing my pants! Hell, I turned that apartment upside down looking for those clothes."
"Well, it looks like Mr. Joachim found them. Here, let's pull back into the room. I'm pretty sure he can't see us, but it won't hurt to be just sure." As Jerry crossed St. Peter's, he stopped and looked hard both ways before continuing. "Yeah, he's looking for the car." As he drew near, I could see that he was holding the pants up as far as they would go by looping his left thumb through a belt loop. The cuffs were slipping down under his heels. The combination gave him a sort of rolling shuffle.
"He's ruining my purple jeans!"
"Arlene, if he was to take off right now and throw them up here, would you do anything but burn them?"
"You're right on that, Johnny C. They were ruined when he put his filthy self into them, but man, he is pissing me off."
I remembered Narlene mad. I didn't want her losing her temper 50 feet above Royal Street. I hoped she just kept laughing. "Let me guess. You only brought the purple jeans and some dresses with you, right?" She turned toward me and thought a second.
Well, I also had a pair of short shorts and a nightgown.
Well, thank God he finally decided on the pants. Oh, I got it. I've been trying to remember who he looks like. It's a drunken Popeye the Sailor. Drunken Popeye rolled on down Royal Street, passing right in front of us, and stopped in this intersection. He apparently didn't see the car at first, and walked on across the street as cars came through the intersection. But when he reached the far sidewalk, he took another look and shuffled on down toward the car. I reached into my pocket and pulled out my phone. I held it up so that Narlene could see it. As soon as Jerry reached the car, I pointed at the phone, and it rang. I put it to my mouth. Yeah, we see him. Thanks. And hung up. To Narlene, I said, and that's why I'm confident that you'll be safe here tonight. Narlene nodded.
I'm not freaked out anymore. I'll be all right.
Meanwhile, down the block, Jerry was systematically tugging on one car door after another. I asked, did you throw his keys off the balcony too?
They might have been in his pants. I didn't look in the pockets, that's for sure.
By now, Jerry was banging on the driver's window with both hands, the purple jeans sliding further off his skinny butt with each hit.
If he doesn't have the keys, why is he so desperate to get in the car?
It's the trunk, I think. Jerry probably never locks the car himself, and he has a spare key hidden in the trunk so he can hit the trunk release and dig it out. Or maybe he keeps some clothes in the trunk and he's tired of having to hold up his pants. So anyway, Paranoid Ray made sure every window was rolled up and all the doors were locked when he parked the car last night. Maybe because there's a serious amount of Super Pot in the trunk, or whatever. And now Jerry is having a really bad day. Jerry stopped hitting the car and stalked off downtown on Chartres, back toward his apartment on Barracks. I sat there, sipping what was left of my latte, in the epicenter of the French Quarter, thinking I could be down to the car, pop the trunk with one of Mick's screwdrivers, and be back in 5 minutes, tops. Well, 10 minutes if you count all the up and down on the stairs and stopping to explain to Tommy. 10 minutes, tops. But what was there to gain? So what if I did find 20 pounds of blueberry pot in the trunk? Was I just going to pick it up and walk away with it in broad daylight? I'd only have to get it as far as NOLA, USA. Somehow I thought Vera would take a real dim view of driving down to bail me out of Orleans Parish Jail. Again. And I imagine that Goat might be just a little pissed too. Then, as if Providence was rescuing me from myself, a tow truck came bouncing down to loose. It actually passed the car by and was waiting to pull onto Chartres, and the driver must have noticed the ticket fluttering from the windshield. Before you could say, excuse me, sir, I would appreciate it if you wouldn't tow my car, that tow truck had locked onto the Bonneville and it was headed toward the light on Decatur. I turned to Narlene, who'd been watching the band below. I gestured toward the receding car. And now I think Jerry's day just got even worse. Always lecturing.
You have been listening to Serve It Cold by Ronnie Blackwell, starring Eric Rowe and Beth Wojcicki. Diverse parts by Roger Johnson, Mike Wynn, Martha Holloway, Paul Fisher, and Julia Holloway. Theme song, Where is the Love by Michelle Malone. You can find out more about her and her music at www.michellemalone.com. Artwork, courtesy of Georgia Godwin and Laura Mann. Serve It Cold is a free audiobook available at dancingcatstudios.com. This and many other fine works are also available at podiobooks.com. For a print or ebook version of the book, visit ronnieblackwell.com or search for it by name at lulu.com. Dancing Cat Studios produces full cast dramatizations of novel length fiction. We'd love to hear from you. You can shoot us questions and comments by email at dancingcatstudios@gmail.com or start some wild speculation about your favorite episodes at our website, dancingcatstudios.com, or just pick up the phone and give us a call at 206-350-7613. Serve It Cold is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 U.S. license. A copy of this license is available at creativecommons.org. Ronnie would be delighted for you to share episodes of this work as often as you like, with as many people as you like, provided, of course, that you give credit where credit is due, you do not charge any fee, you do not use any part of an episode to create something new, and you only copy episodes in their entirety. Some sound effects are courtesy of the Free Sound Project. Direct links and complete credits can be found at DancingCatStudios.com. Episode 7 featured bona fide examples of a national guitar played well and truly by Lenny Gerthofer. Lenny sells these marvelous instruments from his website, VintageNationals.com. Sitting in for the street band are the Hypnotics. You heard Big Mary's, I Feel It Too, and the beginning of Planning an Accident. The Hypnotics music is available from the PodSafe Music Network, and you can also check them out at the band site, which is scotteldridge.com. That's scotteldridge.com. And because it deserves to be heard without people talking over it, here's Big Mary's. Begin to call.